And a happy birthday today to Mary Lynch of Jefferson, to Leon McCoy of Spirit Lake, and to Stephen Lloyd of Thurman. A happy birthday to you all today. You're joined on your birthday today by actor Jack Nicholson, who turns 87. And if we've got any Peter Frampton fans out there, you'll want to know that he turned 74 today. We hope you all have a great birthday. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call. We're at 515-243-6833. We need to get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. We're going to turn now to obituaries, and I need to tell you that we have a lot today. So hang in there with us. It's going to take us a while to make our way through all of them. So particularly if you're listening for a specific one, we'll get to it. We're going to take the next several minutes to do them all. So here is Scott for the first few.
Thank you, Twyla. Start with Richard Bailey Lancaster, who passed away in Indianapolis, Indiana on April 15th, 2024. He was born August 15, 1931 in Tulsa, Oklahoma and raised in Detroit, Michigan. Graduated from Henry Ford Trade School, where his father taught English. He attended Graceland College, where he met the love of his life, Rita Russell, his wife of 70 years. After graduation from Wayne State University, Richard and Rita married and moved to Tallahassee, Florida, where Richard received his master's in sociology. Richard's first career was at the Community of Christ Church World Headquarters in Independence, Missouri. While working, Richard also obtained his Bachelor of Divinity at St. Paul's School of Theology in Kansas City. His passion for learning then led Richard to the field of higher education. After getting his PhD at the University of Michigan, Richard held many positions in college administration, including president of Simpson College in Indianola, Iowa, and vice president of development at Beloit College in Beloit, Wisconsin, and Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana. Prior to retirement, Richard was executive director of the Minnesota Foundation, now part of the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation. Richard loved words, reading, reciting, poetry, and above all, conversing with people. He embraced many interests, including social justice, travel, and golf. He was a member of Twin Lakes Golf Club in Carmel, Indiana, and was proud of getting 5 hole-in-ones during his playing years. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra or the Indianapolis Art Museum. New Fields services will be held at a future date. Next, we've got Alvin William Zimmerman, who was born on October the 2nd, 1939 in Springfield, Minnesota, to Rudolph and Marie Zimmerman. He passed away peacefully on April the 4th, 2024, with his devoted wife Marie at his side. Al had a wide array of interests and hobbies, and they were often reflected in the many careers he had over his lifetime. Growing up in Waverly, Iowa, he was found all over town doing an array of odd jobs like newspaper carrier, car hop, and pin setter at the local bowling alley. He spent time in the Army as a photographer in Hawaii. Graduated from the University of Northern Iowa in 1966 and earned his master's from the University of Iowa in 1971. Al discovered one of his biggest passions was learning and educating others. This is reflected by his chosen professions, first as a history, economics, and photography teacher in Iowa City, then as the AEA media director in Sioux City and the ESD-12 media director in Bremerton, Washington. He then ventured into an educational sales position for several companies, including National Geographic. To his daughters and granddaughters, he was a human jungle gym, master storyteller, on-call landscaper and tree planter, miniature train conductor, world's best goulash maker, billiards master, adventure enabler, and life lesson imparter. He'd be the first to tell you, though, that the most important roles were that of a loving husband, father, and papa. Next, we've got Katie Kendall of Ankeny, Katie was born on June 28, 1935, on a farm outside Exira, Iowa. She passed away on April the 13th, 2024, at her home in Ankeny. She graduated from the Broad Lawns Nursing School in Des Moines in 1956. She married Ray Kendall on December 28th, 1957. They had three children, Catherine, Julie, and Mark. She lost Ray in 1979 and Mark in 2021. She never stopped grieving their passing. She worked as a nurse for decades and volunteered at a clinic in Des Moines for many years after retiring. Her volunteer activities extended far beyond nursing. She was once voted Volunteer of the Year for Iowa Public Television. The past few years found her frequently at Holy Trinity Lutheran helping with the food pantry and other activities. It was in her DNA to find ways to help others every day. A celebration of life will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, April the 24th, 2024 at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church, 517 Southwest Des Moines Street, Ankeny, Iowa. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, April the 23rd, 2024 at the church. Burial will be at Highland Memory Gardens Cemetery at noon on Wednesday, April the 24th, 2024. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations to the food pantry in her memory. holytrinityankeny.org/foodpantry.html for more information and how to donate. Next, we've got Jerry Michael Wadden, W-A-D-D-E-N, age 85, who was born on May the 11th, 1938, and died peacefully on January the 5th, 2024 in Des Moines. Long-standing congestive heart failure was his cause of death. His last days were spent in the compassionate care of hospice workers at Every Step Kavanaugh, where his wife and daughter were able to talk, listen, and hold his hands until he took his last breath. Before going to hospice, he spent a month in the care of many devoted Mercy nurses, CNAs, and doctors who will remember him as a kind and grateful patient. Jerry leaves behind a legacy of integrity, intelligence, reliability, and thoughtfulness. Over the years, he was recognized with numerous accolades, but he was proudest of his roles as a steadfast, loving husband, father, trusted brother, and friend. Graduated from North High School and worked at the Des Moines Register to pay for college at Drake University, where he later earned a master's degree in English. He was a revered educator at Tech, East, Merrill, and Hoover. His students remember him as a captivating and fiercely dedicated teacher who cared for them like family. He found his calling in teaching, and his light continues to shine through the many lives he touched. After teaching for 35 years, he took a leadership position as supervisor of language arts and finally as chief academic officer for the Des Moines Public Schools, where his impact was legendary. Jerry was respected in the local community and was engaged mentor to many. The week before he was hospitalized, he continued to help retirees choose insurance plans, something he had done for more than 10 years while volunteering with SHIP. In his later years, he enthusiastically learned to cook and had fun serving others, especially his wife, Marilyn. He also looked forward to lunches with longtime dear friends, laughing with family and neighbors, and reminiscing with former students and colleagues. He was an avid reader of newspapers, magazines, and books until the last weeks of his life. Jerry supported several charities, especially Animal Rescue League, Salvation Army, and Hope Ministries. He would be honored if he wanted to contribute to one of them in his memory. The family held a private visitation in January and invites you to the public memorial service at Des Moines Botanical Center at 11 a.m. on Friday, May the 3rd, 2024. Please visit hamiltonsfuneralhome.com to share your memories and stories about Jerry. Next is Jeffrey Houston Green, who died in his 77th year on Easter Sunday, March 31st, 2024, after short stays in Methodist Hospital and Taylor House, Unity Point Hospice in Des Moines. Both places provided fine care for him and deeply appreciated help for his family. He had been struck by a car during one of his customary long afternoon walks and did not recover. Jeff was an inveterate daily walker enjoying the wonderful walking trail systems in Des Moines, as well as the sidewalks in his current and previous neighborhoods, Tawanda Drive, Urbandale, and Beaverdale's Frank Smith Center, where he enjoyed his congenial neighbors. His joy in walking harmonized with his love of nature and especially of being in the woods. Walking also got him to his neighborhood library, where he was a regular visitor. Reading was a lifelong pleasure, informed by his ever-present maps and reference materials. He imparted those loves of reading and nature to his niece and nephews, for whom he was a wonderful uncle. He had a dramatic way of reading nursery rhymes that was absolutely unique. In fact, the whole family could enjoy hearing him read when we gathered at Okoboji. Okoboji also fostered Jeff's great love of fishing. He fished there as well as in Alaska and Canada and in trout streams in Iowa, which he helped to conserve and improve. A few years ago, he was able to donate his fly tying equipment to further educate the craft to new young fishing enthusiasts. Jeff attended Roosevelt High School and Simpson College. His main work was at the family business, Iowa Supply Company. His life before retirement was affected by little understood but very real condition, a circadian rhythm sleep disorder, a chronic misalignment of a person's circadian rhythm with the way most people experience their days. He was a night owl. It was not a choice nor a moral failure, but how his body worked. We hope that the fact that people can vary their day physiological rhythms will be understood and accommodated better in the future. Arrangements have been handled by Hamilton's on Westtown Funeral Home. Jeff's cremains will join four older generations of his families at Masonic Cemetery in Des Moines, Iowa. There will be a memorial gathering this summer. Details will be posted on hamiltonsfuneralhome.com.
And continuing now with more obituaries, Larry Dean Conrath of Des Moines was born December 12, 1937, to Audley and Doris Conrath. He went to heaven on April 12. He is survived by his loving wife of 52 years, Mary, son Ryan, daughters Lori and partner Ben, Holly, partner Armand, granddaughters Gabby, Allie, Sophie, and Lila. The family will greet friends Monday, April 22, from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m., with a memorial service to follow at 6 p.m. at Hamilton's Southtown Funeral Home on Southwest 9th Street. Condolences may be expressed on the Hamilton Funeral Home website. From Woodward, Claudia Borchers. Claudia L. Borchers, age 78, went to be with her Lord and Savior on April 13 at the Madrid Nursing Home. Claudia's full obituary may be found online at neptunescremationdesmoines.com. From Clive, Donnie Herman. Donnie Dean Herman, age 60, passed away peacefully on April 14. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, April 24, at Memorial Services of Iowa on North Ankeny Boulevard. A funeral service will be held at 2:30 p.m. Thursday, April 25, also at the funeral home, with burial to follow at Ankeny Memorial Gardens. Donnie and his brother built and ran Herman's Fine Jewelry together for almost 50 years. Donnie is survived by his mother, Shirley, his former wife, Amy, and their children, Connor, Danae, her partner, Dustin Schomburg, and Lily Herman and his brother, Frank Herman. A full obituary is online at ankenymemorial.com. From Sioux Falls, John Engstrom. John Edward Engstrom, age 77, formerly of Des Moines, passed away unexpectedly of natural causes on Wednesday, March 13, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Visitation with family present will be Saturday, April 27, from 10 a.m. to noon at St. John's Lutheran Church on 6th Avenue in Des Moines. A prayer service and time of sharing will be held at 10:30 a.m. Burial of his cremains will take place at 3 p.m. at Amsterdam Township Cemetery in Kanawha, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Food Bank of Iowa, and arrangements are handled by Anderson and Sons Funeral Home. Robert Slater of Des Moines, Robert, sometimes known Bob, E. Slater, age 92, died on Thursday, April 18, at Trinity Center in Lutheran Park, following surgery for a fractured hip. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, April 26, at St. John's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Laurel Hill Cemetery. A live stream of the service and online condolences are available on Bob's obituary page on the Isles Carers Funeral Home website. From New Virginia, William, known as Bill Luddington, son of Glenn and Polly Luddington, was born July 9 of 1935 and passed from this life on Friday, April 19 at 88 years of age. Bill worked as a flooring installer for Ralph Smith Company for many years. William enjoyed racing cars in his early years and was crazy about motorcycles. Bill leaves to cherish his memory, his wife Blanca Luddington. Per his wishes, Bill's body was donated to science and his cremains will be buried at a later date. Online condolences may be directed to the family at kalefuneralhome.com. From West Des Moines, Suzanne Reif Farrington. Heaven gained the most special angel on April 17. Suzanne Reif Farrington, age 89, passed away in West Des Moines. Services will be held at Edgewater in West Des Moines on Monday, April 22 at 3 p.m. There will be visitation following the services. Suzanne is survived by her daughter Jennifer, grandchildren Kelly, Susan, partner Rudy, Jamie, partner Gabrielle, Gretchen, Cassidy, Sydney, and Morgan, and great-grandchildren Jocelyn, Amity, Seth, Boston, Sage, Elijah, Dominic, Vivian, Florence, Eleanor, and Emmett. She was preceded in death by her loving husband, John, her parents, her sister, her son, Robert, and her daughter, Cynthia. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to the Alzheimer's Association or St. Luke's Church on Hilton Head, South Carolina. Edgewater is located at 9225 Cascade Avenue in West Des Moines. The services will be held on the second floor. Elizabeth Fetterman of Des Moines. Elizabeth, known as Betty Ashoff Fetterman, age 91, entered into eternal life on April 16. She was born on July 21st, 1932, in Randolph, Nebraska, to Robert and Angeline Ashoff. She has lived in Randolph, Nebraska, Sioux City, Iowa, Moultrie, Georgia, Marshalltown, Iowa, West Des Moines, Iowa, and Johnston, Iowa. She liked to spend her time reading, playing golf, quilting, and watching her beloved cubs, and working in her yard. She would often spend quiet time in prayer and was quite the prayer warrior for her family, friends, and countless anonymous individuals. She was a beloved wife, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother who dearly loved her entire family. Visitation will be held at Sacred Heart Catholic Church on Friday, April 26, from 5 to 7, which will begin with a rosary service. Mass of Christian burial will begin at 10 a.m. Saturday, April 27, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church on Grand Avenue in West Des Moines, with burial to follow in Rest Haven Cemetery in West Des Moines. Memorial donations may be made to Jonathan's House for Orphans at jonathanhouse.org or mailed to Jonathan's House, car P.O. Box 480 in Wheaton, Illinois. Leroy Joe Law of Des Moines, age 86, passed away peacefully on April 15. Leroy was born to John and Pearl Law on March 16, 1938, in Audubon. The family moved to Des Moines in 1943. Following graduation from East High School, he worked as a mailer for Wallace Homestead for 8 years and Meredith Printing / R.R. Donnelly for 34 years. He enjoyed pitching and promoting horseshoes and was inducted into the Iowa Hawkeye Horseshoe Pitchers Association Hall of Fame in 2008. He served as superintendent of horseshoes at the Iowa State Fair, director of Iowa Senior Games horseshoes and tournaments and leagues in West Des Moines for many years. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., with funeral service to begin at 1 p.m. Saturday, April 27, at Hamilton's Funeral Home on Lyon Street in downtown Des Moines. Burial will be held on a later date at Sunset Memorial Gardens Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, the family is requesting that donations be made out to hospice or other caregiver associations. Mary Reynolds of Norwalk. A celebration of life for Mary Lou Reynolds, age 80, who passed away April 15, will be held at 1 p.m. April 28 at the Croatian Center on Indianola Avenue in Des Moines. Memorials in memory of Mary Lou may be given to the family for a contribution at a later date or to an organization important to your family. Mary Lou was a teacher in the Des Moines public school system, where she taught mostly first grade for over 40 years. Many of her students were gifted with what was called a Reynolds wrap, her signature hug. Mary Lou was preceded in death by her parents, her in-laws, and a grandson, Dawson Reynolds. Surviving are husband Kemp, children Pat and partner Lisa, Tammy, partner Clint Hill, Kim, children, grandchildren Tyler and Jordan Reynolds, Emily and Sabrina Hill, and Abby Ernst, and many extended family and friends. You may sign online condolences or visit her obituary website at Overton Funeral Homes. Coralie Good of Dallas Center passed away on April 19 at Spurgeon Manor Retirement Community in Dallas Center, Iowa. Coralie was born on October 5, 1928 in Salem, Illinois, to Reuben and Nellie Garner. She was the youngest of two children. Her brother, Dwight Garner, was 7 years older. She was raised in several different communities as her father, a blacksmith, roamed from Illinois to California and Iowa with approximately 20 moves. Her final move landed them in Dallas Center, attending her senior year of high school. She loved being a new student that allowed her many opportunities, including cheerleading and dating many of the boys who found her appealing since she was the new girl in class. She met the love of her life, Jimmy Good, one summer day walking down the street in Dallas Center, just returning from the Army as a World War II paratrooper, and asked him if he would like a ride. That was it. They were united in marriage on April 9, 1950. The two spent the rest of their life in Dallas Center in the same house, raising one daughter, Leanne Good Opie. Coralie went to work just out of high school in the Dallas County Courthouse in Adel, Iowa, and Luthi Hardware in Grimes, Iowa. She then moved to Des Moines, working for the Equitable Life Insurance Company. Once married, she was a homemaker, raising her daughter until she attended late elementary school. Coralie then took on a part-time job with the Church of the Brethren Regional Office, later with the Dallas Center Farmers Cooperative and Continental Western Life Insurance Company, all in a clerical capacity. She belonged to the United Methodist Church, where she served in the Women's Fellowship Group and the choir. She was a volunteer secretary to the Board of Spurgeon Manor Retirement Community for 10 years and a member of the American Legion Auxiliary. The family, and later in retirement as a couple, traveled extensively throughout the United States, beginning with a one-time trip to Colorado with a pickup topper, which gradually grew into full-size luxury travel trailer. Most of their destinations included various western locations in Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, Arizona, New Mexico, California, and Canada. They loved the mountains, camping with their grandchildren, and taking them to many Iowa lakes fishing. Belovedly known as Grammy, she enjoyed cooking family dinners and holiday events. Her well-known family recipes and everyday cooking was always a hit with everyone who sat down at her table. She was a tireless cook. She also kept a few homemade cookies that were lovingly stashed in the freezer for her grandchildren to find. She will be in our hearts forever. We miss you, Mama, Mom, Grammy. The family would like to thank her friends and neighbors who have stood by her through the ups and downs of life. The stability of these lifelong friendships have meant more to her than you know. We would also like to thank Spurgeon Manor for her end-of-life care and support. A remembrance service will be held at the Brandt Funeral Home in Dallas Center on April 25 at 10:30 a.m. Friends are welcome starting at 10. The interment will be at the Brethren Cemetery. Donations may be given to the United Methodist Church in Dallas Center. Online condolences are welcome at the Isles Care Funeral Home website. From Des Moines, Herman Verdon, age 83, passed away on Thursday, April 18, at Mercy One Medical Center in Des Moines. He was born on July 10, 19, was preceded in death by his parents, John and Mildred Verdon, and brothers John Verdon and Virgil Verdon. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., with funeral services to begin at 12 p.m. Tuesday, April 23, at Hamilton's Funeral Home on Lyon Street in Des Moines. Burial will follow at Laurel Hill Cemetery. From West Des Moines, Elsa Adele McDowell. Adele was born on February 17 in 1927 to Elsa and John Schoeneman at their farm near Kelsey, Iowa. She joined Oreen Eldon and Ruth Schoeneman, and Sister Joan followed. As a child, she developed a love of being outdoors, playing piano, reading, and singing. Holidays with her parents, siblings, and many nieces and nephews were a beloved part of life. In 1962, the McDowell family moved to Decorah. Adele graduated from Luther College, cum laude, in 1967. She resumed teaching at Eastside Elementary School and then at middle schools in Eagle Grove, Iowa, Tacoma, Washington, and Des Moines. She earned her Master's of Arts degree in 1974. At the First United Methodist Church, she sang in the choir, participated in community outreach programs, and served on missions to Kenya and New Orleans. She was an avid conversationalist and enriched the lives of her five children, their families, and friends. In lieu of flowers, live your life to the fullest. Any contributions may be directed to Des Moines Symphony, the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, or the organization of your choice. Mega Green Stevens of Des Moines passed away on Sunday, April 14, at the age of 77. She was born in Hamburg, Germany on February 12 in 1947 to parents who were born in Latvia. The Abolins family moved to the United States in 1951 and settled in Des Moines. Miga was married to William Green until his passing at age 50. They had two children, Billy and Stephanie. Miga worked for insurance companies and at a treatment center for teenagers. She enjoyed gardening, decorating, and collecting unique paintings and antiques for her home. She's survived by her current husband of 26 years, Ted Stevens. A celebration of life will be held at the White House, 1400 Pennsylvania Avenue on Des Moines, on September 28 from 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. Ralph Dwayne Munyon of Des Moines, aged 86, passed away at Trinity Center on Saturday, April 13. The family will greet friends on Saturday, April 28, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Hamilton Southtown Funeral Home on Southwest 9th Street. Funeral services will be held on Monday, April 29 at 12 p.m. at Lutheran Church of Hope on Jordan Creek Parkway in West Des Moines. To express condolences and see a full obituary, go to the Hamilton's Funeral Home website. Albert Knight Jr. of Polk City, age 69, beloved husband, father, grandfather, son, uncle, and friend, passed away unexpectedly on April 17. Born on March 31, 1955, in Des Moines, Al was the son of Albert and Charlene Knight. He graduated from Lincoln High on the south side of Des Moines in 1973 and the University of Northern Iowa in 1977. He went on to pursue a career spanning over 40 years in the HVAC industry. He is survived by his wife, Joyce, several children, a sister, many nieces and nephews who will cherish his memory. Al was preceded in death by grandparents Telford and Beatrice Loden and Edna Knight. A service to celebrate Al's life will be held at 11 a.m. with visitation from 9 to 11 a.m. on Wednesday, April 24 at Salem United Church of Christ on Northeast 141st Street in Allaman, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the church for their window fund, and you may find a full obituary at theankenymemorial.com. And finally, Robert Wheels of Des Moines. Robert Don Eldon Wheels, age 79, at Des Moines, passed away on Friday, April 12, at the Veterans CLC. A graveside service will be held at Iowa Veterans Cemetery on Thursday, April 25, at 2 p.m. You can see a full obituary at the Hamilton Funeral Home website. And I think, Scott, that we're close enough to a shift change that we will wrap this up and go to our shift change. without proceeding to any more news. We'll leave the rest of that to the next shift. For the past 90 minutes, your readers have been Scott Splavik and me, Twyla Glenn. It's been our pleasure to read for you. And now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Carol Lockard and Jeff Cassett. We'll continue now with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Carol with our first opinion piece.
Thank you, Jeff. Passover arrives at a dangerous time for Jews. This article is written by Nathan J. Diamant, who is Executive Director of Public Policy for the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America. Jews will gather Monday for the Passover Seder as we have for centuries. Children are taught to ask four questions with the opening. Why is this night different from all other nights? This year, there is a fifth question American Jewish families will ask at their Seder table. What is our place today in America? This year, Jews will celebrate Passover in the shadow of Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, the bloodiest day for Jews since the Holocaust, and amid the largest surge in anti-Semitism ever in the United States. As we celebrate our freedom from Egypt, we will think about the Jews who are hostages in Gaza, taken captive solely because they are Jews. We will cry as we retell the biblical atrocities against our ancestors that rhyme with the brutality of our present-day foes. For American Jews, our current anxiety is not only out of concern for our Israeli brothers and sisters. It also is because we are shocked by those who have taken to the streets to praise Hamas and denounce Jews. Liberal Jews being abandoned by former allies in progressive causes. In the United States, unprecedented protests have been mounted outside synagogues and Jewish-owned businesses have been vandalized. And, of course, there is the over-the-top animus on university campuses where Jewish students and faculty are harassed and threatened without consequences to the perpetrators. In this context, in this moment, every American Jewish family will ask at their cedar table, is the golden age of American Jewry over? A teenager will turn to a grandparent and ask, are we watching a replay of 1930s Germany here? These questions will be asked by Orthodox Jews who are acutely tuned to the patterns of Jewish history, which tells of golden ages that have come and gone for centuries. And these questions will be asked by liberal Jews who might have reservations about how Israel has prosecuted its war against Hamas, but have even greater reservations about their erstwhile friends and colleagues siding with Hamas. These Jews have fought on the front lines of many progressive causes for racial, economic, women's, LGBTQ+, and other rights. Now they find themselves abandoned by alleged allies when it was time to stand against Jews being victims of rape and murder. While the Haggadah provides answers to the four traditional Passover questions, it leaves this question of this moment unanswered. That answer will depend on the American people and how we, collectively, write our course and respond to this decisive moment in American Jewish history. But the Passover story makes one thing clear. In the age-old fight between good and evil, good will triumph. There's a reason the Passover Seder is the most observed Jewish ritual across the full spectrum of Jews. It holds a message of promise that the Jewish people will endure in the face of unimaginable evil. Great empires, Greek, Roman, Ottoman, and British, have come and gone, but we Jews remain. Decisive moment for America. Non-Jews gravitate toward the Passover story for the same reason. Indeed, Exodus makes a frequent cameo in America's founding story. In 1776, Ben Franklin proposed a national seal with the image of Moses standing on the shore and extending his hand over the sea with the motto, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." From the abolitionist era to the civil rights movement, the idea of people being delivered from servitude to freedom captured the American imagination. Today, Americans have an opportunity to side with good and freedom over evil and tyranny. A society that turns the other cheek in the face of those who persecute Jews, because they are Jews, will ultimately lose their freedoms for all. From university administrators to the White House, to the average man on the street, this is a decisive moment for all of us. Our choice as a country will not only determine what happens to the Jewish people, but what happens to the American people as well. Jeff?
Israel sign triggered a riot at my school. We had a talk. This article by Karen Marder, who is a teacher in Queens, New York, and Randy Weingarten, who is president of the American Federation of Teachers. As teachers, we try to impart to young people that life often defies binary delineations. As Jews, we can be heartsick and horrified over the October 7 attack on Israel by Hamas, the death, suffering, and capture of hundreds of Israelis, and now, as the war drags on, thousands of innocent Palestinians. We can demand the release of Israeli hostages and fight for humanitarian aid for Gazans now starving. We can fight against hate and for free expression. We can embrace security, freedom, and self-determination for both peoples. What is not up for debate is this, our basic humanity. That goes for students and for the adults who guide them. 2 days after the Hamas massacre, one of us, Karen Martyr, a teacher at Hillcrest High School in Queens, New York, attended a vigil with others who were devastated by the deadliest attack on Jews since the Holocaust. Karen says, "News of the torture, rape, and slaughter of young people at a music festival especially disturbed me. I saw their zest for life in my own young adult children and the thousands of students I'd taught over more than two decades. I posted a photo on Facebook of myself holding a sign reading, 'I stand with Israel.' That act, in the hours after the Hamas assaults, would lead to a devastating response from students I care about deeply." Several of Karen's students circulated screenshots of the photo and called for a riot targeting her. On November 20th, hundreds of students stormed the hallway and tried to get into her classroom, cursing and threatening, and calling for her to be fired. Karen was elsewhere in the building but watched all of this on monitors, and she later saw videos that students shared online. In a cruel irony, the lesson she had planned to teach on that day of the riot was about hate crimes. Karen again. "I had a choice to transfer to a different school. I stayed to use the experience to connect, to listen, learn, debunk misinformation, and combat intolerance. The day I returned to school, a Palestinian friend and fellow teacher and I met with students. I answered their questions and shared my feelings. I repeated the hurtful, threatening, and untrue things that students had said during the riot and on social media, helping them connect with my humanity and their own. Many of my students hugged me and apologized for what had occurred. For me, it was difficult to go back to work. What happened to me was frightening and horrible and something that no teacher, staff member, or student should have to experience, particularly in a school building. Dealing with that trauma and the press surrounding it is a long process, one that'll take time to heal. However, I went back because I knew one thing. I had to talk with my students. I had to make them understand the context of my post and why it was posted when it was. I had to listen. I had to understand what messages they were absorbing and where they were coming from. I had to answer their questions, address their fears and confusions, and simply be there. Further, I had to show them that I wasn't going to run away, even though some of them behaved inappropriately. They had to see, through my actions, that I would not give up on them, that I'd keep coming in again and again. That said, those conversations were not easy. Trust, once breached, must be earned back. Teachers must model so much for students: forgiveness, active listening, acknowledging wrongs, and sitting with uncomfortable feelings. We don't have to paint things as black and white, right or wrong. We humans can see nuance, shades of gray, areas of commonality among difference. This is what gives me hope as a teacher navigating the challenging world of school and students, but also for the situation between Israel and Palestine. There is another path forward for all humans, one of peace, negotiation, and decency. As teachers, we can start our students on that road." As acts of hate against Muslims and Jews have surged in recent months, and as the culture wars have targeted people for their race, sexual orientation, and gender identity, people have become scared. We hear this from teachers all the time. Karen's experience and her response show a way forward. Schools must be safe and welcoming places, safe from physical violence and safe for people regardless of who they are. That means acts of anti-Semitic and anti-Arab hate must be addressed, not ignored. But we need more than that. Education is about knowledge, of course, but knowledge is more than memorizing facts. It involves critical thinking, empathy, and deepening understanding and respect for diverse backgrounds and perspectives. Karen, again, quoting, "I didn't hide, and neither should others. If something is brewing, we must act, not pretend it will go away." That's what Karen's union, the United Federation of Teachers, did before that riot, and that is what New York City School Chancellor David Banks has pledged to do. In our public schools and our public squares, we must responsibly exercise our right to free speech, combat hate, intolerance, and misinformation, and foster respectful discussions and debates, even and perhaps especially about challenging topics. Karen's actions are a ray of light in our hope for peaceful solution to this most intractable of conflicts, anchored in our shared values of empathy and basic humanity.
And that concludes the opinions for today. So we'll go to the sports pages. This article is about someone coming to Iowa to play football. North Dakota offensive line transfer Cade Borod has committed to Iowa football, he announced. This comes after Borod was in attendance for Iowa's practice at Kinnick Stadium on Saturday. After appearing sparingly and redshirting the 2022 season, Borod started 12 games at center last season for North Dakota and was named a Phil Steele FCS second-team freshman All-American. He will arrive at Iowa for 3 seasons of college eligibility remaining. Borod attended Southeast Polk High School outside of Des Moines, where he was teammates with current Iowa safety Xavier Nwankpa. He's rated as a 3-star transfer portal prospect, according to 247 Sports. The Hawaii's O-line was a major deficiency in 2021 and 2022, becoming one of the biggest issues in a sinking offense. But that unit did make meaningful strides last season. Iowa averaged 111.9 rushing yards per game in 2023, compared to 94.8 the season prior. It also gave up 2.29 sacks per game last season versus 2.92 the season before. Still, that unit has plenty of room to improve. Iowa is returning most key parts of last season's offensive line, which means it would be a disappointment if that unit is unable to continue its upward trajectory this fall. The only main contributor Iowa lost from last season's unit is Rusty Feth, who proved to be a valuable addition from the transfer portal in his only season with the Hawkeyes. Iowa tried to make a splash in the transfer portal this offseason, and briefly, it looked like it did. The Hawkeyes landed the commitment of Alabama offensive line transfer Caden Proctor, but his time being a Hawkeye didn't last long, as he has since left the program. Borod isn't the flashy addition that Proctor was, but he could still be of value in the long term, if not short term, too. Jeff?
Here are the sports you can enjoy on TV today. for Monday, we've got National Hockey League. They're starting Stanley Cup playoffs, of course. It's 7 o'clock on ESPN, Toronto at Boston. At 7:30 on ESPN2, New York Islanders at Carolina. And at 9:30 on ESPN, Vegas at Dallas. And 10 o'clock on ESPN2, the LA Kings at Edmonton. We have NBA basketball playoffs as well. 7 p.m. on NBA TV, Orlando at Cleveland. At 7:30 on TNT, Philadelphia at the New York Knicks. At 10 o'clock on TNT, LA Lakers at Denver. It just occurred to me that it says all times Eastern, so those events will all be aired here in Des Moines and Iowa just an hour earlier. On Major League Baseball at noon, or a little after noon, Oakland at the New York Yankees on MLB TV, and at 6:40, Chicago at the Minnesota Twins. At 8:38, on MLB Network, Baltimore at Los Angeles, and at 8:45 on ESPN and MLB, the New York Mets at San Francisco. Chun earns the USA Wrestling Women's Coach of the Year. Iowa women's wrestling coach Clarissa Chun has been awarded the USA Wrestling Women's Coach of the Year Award, her second Coach of the Year Award this season. Chun led the Iowa Hawkeyes to a team title in their inaugural season of competition, as well as coaching six individual national champions in Emily Gonzalez, Ava Bayless, Felicity Taylor, Reese Laramendi, Marlon Didi, and Kylie Welker. In total, Iowa had 12 NCWWC All-Americans and 15 qualifiers. "We're just getting started," Chun said after the NCWWC's. "Our women just grew closer each moment and opportunity out on the mat. They know what it means to fight for Iowa." Iowa concluded its dual season with a 16-0 regular season record, outscoring its opponents 593-108 in duels this season. If you take away the three matchups at the Las Vegas Desert Duels, where the Hawkeyes were without several starters and were forced to forfeit multiple matches with several wrestlers competing at senior nationals, Iowa outpaced opponents 510-54. A total of nine Hawkeye women qualified for the U.S. Olympic trials. The six title winners, plus Rose Cassiope, Brianna Gonzalez, and Nyla Valencia. Chun was awarded the NCWWC Coach of the Year Award following the Hawkeyes' title in Cedar Rapids. In addition to that, she also won the USA Today Woman of the Year in the state of Iowa. The Hawkeyes, under Chun, were primed for another successful season in 2025, returning four national title winners and 10 All-Americans to the fold, as well as talented crew of freshmen.
And just a little bit of this one, won't be able to finish it. Ionis Q relishes growth of WNBA. If there needed to be any more evidence of how women's sports continue to grow, it was a raucous crowd full of children and teenagers when Sabrina Ionescu stepped foot inside the Los Angeles Boys and Girls Gym Club. The gym was that's Boys and Girls Club Gym. The gym was renovated in partnership with 2K Foundations, SLAM, and her S120 Foundations to bring an entirely new court, scoreboard, lighting, and roof to Boys and Girls Club. Ionescu was in attendance for the unveiling. It was her appearance that set all of the youths into a frenzy. A pickup game was set to take place after Ionescu spoke to the crowd, but it was delayed after the players, mostly teenage boys, all huddled around the WNBA star in hopes of getting her autograph. Whenever she signed something, all the teams surrounding her screamed and cheered as they got a coveted signature. Just the other day in the life of a basketball megastar. "It's always kind of a humbling experience," Ionescu told USA Today Sports. "I was once that kid not too long ago, and now being able to understand what it means to build relationships and to just show up, and how important that is to just show a lot of these young boys and girls that we're all human, can put a smile on my face." And now it's time for Dear Abby. Dear Abby, "I am a happy, decidedly single woman with a large group of friends who are all married. Most of us grew up together, and all of us have been like extended family for the last 25 years. This year, one of the wives lost three family members within 3 months. This has been devastating to her, of course, as well as to all of us as we watch her struggle to regain her footing in this new reality. I know firsthand the pain she's living with. My problem is she has started accusing me of having an affair with her husband. Nothing could be further from the truth. I am torn between trying to remember that she's angry and lashing out from her losses and being deeply insulted and angry at her. I've done nothing inappropriate, nor has her husband. I am shocked that she could think such a thing. We see each other often, and I don't know how to treat her. Signed, Friend or Foe in New York. Abby says, Dear friend or foe, I'm concerned for your friend. Are you sure she doesn't have other emotional or marital problems besides her grief? That she would accuse you of having an affair with her husband when nothing of the sort is happening could be a clue that something is wrong with her. Treat her with kindness and suggest that she should talk with a marriage counselor if she feels something has gone wrong in her marriage, because if it's true, it has nothing to do with you. Dear Abby, any suggestions on how to motivate a husband? We've been happily married for 35 years. Now he does nothing but read, eat, and sleep. I am not exaggerating. He started reading about 15 years ago when our boys were teenagers. He was an active parent, Boy Scout leader, baseball coach, umpire, volunteer in the church, got his master's, and took a high-energy exercise program, etc. But then he discovered fantasy fan fiction, free stories on the internet written by unpublished authors. He now reads 16 to 18 hours a day on weekends, plus 10 hours each day during the week. He does nothing else. When I asked if he's depressed, he said, No, he's just tired and wants to relax. He has regular medical checkups, nothing abnormal there. His career is not high stress. I cannot get him to socialize, and he no longer keeps up with his friends. All he looks forward to is retiring in about a year, but I don't want him to retire just to see him read more. This is making for a very lonely marriage. I am unable to motivate him. Signed, Motivated in the East. Abby says, Dear Motivated, it is time for a frank conversation with your husband. Ask him what he's using the fan fiction binging to escape from. Point out the lifestyle he's adopted is not healthy for him or for your marriage. Proceed from there to find out if a compromise would be workable. And then Dear Abby says, Dear readers, at sundown, the first night of Passover begins. This major Jewish holiday celebrates the most momentous event in Jewish history, the liberation of the Jewish people from slavery in Egypt. Happy Passover to my readers who observe this important holiday. Love from Abby. Jeff?
Well, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, the 22nd of April, 2024. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. Earlier, you heard from Scott Splavik and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.